Luke chapter 8, verse 40 says, "Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying." Jesus is hugely popular at this point. He's traveling and talking about God's kingdom like no one ever has before. People are finding hope and help in him. Some people are following him and providing what he needs because he helped them. And sick people are now healthy, and demonized people are now of sound mind, and they are following Jesus. The word is out. Jesus can fix people who are broken or living broken lives. So when he returns to town from another trip, lots of people come to see him. And a man breaks through the crowd and falls on his knees in front of Jesus. Not much falling on our knees anymore. If you see someone do that, you know that that person's brokenhearted, right? They fall to their knees. This guy clearly was. It looks like he hasn't slept in a long time. He's panicky. He's almost unrecognizable in spite of the fact that he's one of the most well-known men in that town. Jairus was a leader of their synagogue. Synagogues are Jewish church buildings. Their real church building was in Jerusalem, the temple where God lived. But they built buildings in each community for teaching, for praying, for gathering synagogues. And synagogue leaders were good guys. They were upstanding citizens. They were smart, godly men who knew the scriptures and who loved the people in the town. Jairus was a model of Jewish manhood, one of the best guys anybody knew, and he had a good life, except for one problem. His little girl, their only child, she's about 12 years old. So you know that she's got her father's heart wrapped around her little finger, right? So Jairus is winning in life, except that his daughter is really, really sick. And they've spent all their money on doctors. And they've prayed and prayed for God to help. And they've tried all the things that the people in town have suggested, but the girl is not getting better. In fact, the daughter is so close to dying that some people are recommending hospice care. Which is why, even though the chief priests and teachers in Jerusalem had labeled Jesus dangerous, which is why, even though the Jewish higher-ups were mostly down on the Galilean upstart, which is why, even though it surprised many people in town to see him go this way, Jairus, knowing that his daughter does not have much time left, abandons his dignity and his status as a leading Jew in town, and he falls at Jesus' feet and begs him to come help her. Jairus figures it's his last shot. And even if everyone else in town is shocked that he would do it, Jesus might be able to help. Jesus might be able to save his little girl. So he went to Jesus. That's how Jairus ended up in front of Jesus. Jairus coming to Jesus is one of the events in the Bible that helped us as a church shape our strategy on how to reach out with the good news in a meaningful way to families in this part of the world. Please note, he came to Jesus. Jesus never forces himself into anyone's life. Even though Jesus knows he can make things better, he will not force his way in. He respects you way too much to just run over you to get what he wants. Which is so unlike us, right? We are so easily tempted to use force in life. If we could force people to do our things, it just seems like it would always be better if they would just do it our way, right now. Driving home from Walmart, on 96, it's 50 miles per hour in front of Chili's, in front of Thirsty Turtle, right? You know that 50 mile per hour stretch? I'm following this lady going 40. And I've got places to get to, and I can't pass, so I am right on her tail as close as I can drive without touching her, almost thinking maybe I should just push her along, right? But no, she stays at 40 the whole way, all the way into town, where the speed limit changes to 30. And she keeps right on going 40. And I am so hoping that cop will be sitting there across from Papa Jack's, ready to pull out from his hiding place and ticket her for going 40. I so want that to happen. We want our kids to play nice together. We want our neighbors to make their dog stop barking. We want our friends to save their marriage. And if we could make it happen, that would be fantastic. We would not hesitate. We would snap our fingers and voila, it would be just like it should be. But even though he could, Jesus never forces anyone into anything, not even a saving relationship with him. So the only people connected to Jesus are those who choose that, who ask for that. And Jairus was asking in Luke 8 because he had a need in his life that he knew only Jesus could meet. And he begged Jesus to come into his home, to come into his life, because he knew Jesus could help his daughter. So our church thinks that if not even Jesus forces himself into anyone's life, probably we shouldn't either, as we probably don't know better than Jesus does. In fact, any religion where the key method for gaining adherence is brute strength or force or fear or coercion, can you say crusades? Any religion that uses force is probably a little off base. That, at least, is not the way our Lord chose to influence people. Instead, he helped them, he served them, he met their needs. Jesus put others first, and in doing so, he won their hearts so that they would want to be friends with him. And our plan for gaining ground is based on Jesus' plan. His strategy would be ours. Since we can't make people live under Jesus' kingship, we knew we needed to help them with something that really matters to them, and in that way show them that we love them, and in that way perhaps interest them in a connection with the guy who can really fix what's broken in their lives, like Jesus is doing in our lives. So we asked ourselves, what needs do people around here have? Some people in the world need food, and we have been part of the Victor Farmington Food Cupboard since before it was called that. And some months, that organization feeds over 600 families from around here who all come in for food, who all need food, who all get some food. But for the most part, people in this area have plenty of food. In fact, we have more than we can eat. In fact, we have more than we should eat. Plus, we go to restaurants daily, weekly, a lot. We eat. Four of us were driving home from camp, and my mom said, "Hey, McDonald's ice cream would be good, wouldn't it?" And we said, "Yeah, that sounds good." So we stopped at McDonald's. But their ice cream machine was broken, and the sign just had all the ice cream crossed out. And when she said, "May I help you?" I said, "Yes, we'd like ice cream." She said, "I'm sorry, our machine is broken. What would you like?" I said, "We would like ice cream." She kind of laughed and said, "Yeah, I got that. What else would you like?" I said, "We would like ice cream." So they didn't have any ice cream, and we were kind of mad and a little hungry, you know. So I drove over to the Quick Fill across the street, and I bought half a gallon of mint chocolate chip ice cream. And I grabbed some coffee spoons from their coffee place, and I dished out that half gallon into two plastic cups that we had in the car, but there were four of us. And I could eat out of the container, no problem, but that left my daughter containerless. But she, being dog savvy, flipped a sandwich bag inside out and scooped herself a handful of mint tingling ice cream. And we all had ice cream, messy though it might have been. Food is not really our issue. Most of us have plenty of food. Shelter? Some people need shelter. Some people around here have no place to live. That's true. And our church helped bring Family Promise, an effort to fix that, to our county. We were first in. Education? Lots of people need education. We've got great schools nearby, pre-K to grad. We have lots of schools around here. Healthcare? Sure, more people need more access to healthcare, but the Rochester area is world famous for healthcare. Now, when we go on missions trips and we meet a young man up in the mountains whose foot, one of his feet point backwards because he broke his ankle as a baby and no one knew how to reset it. So he's lived his whole life with his foot pointing backwards. There are people who have real healthcare needs in the world, but mostly we get care when something goes wrong with our bodies, and usually in the same day. So what needs do people in our community really have that we could meet? This is why the story of Jairus' daughter is so important to what we chose to be as a church. Jairus was willing to give up lots and risk his whole reputation in life if it would help his daughter. Similarly, parents in our part of the world are willing to sacrifice almost anything for their kids. They are willing to change things around if it will help their son or help their daughter. In our part of the world, parents are willing to do almost everything, anything for their kids. And oddly, one of the things that parents around here often think that their kids need is a connection with God. It's weird because the parents don't have that. and they don't think they need it, but they think their kids should know God. Parents will say they never really had anything like that when they were growing up, but somehow they think it would benefit their kids if they would have some formal religious training of some sort. Parents around here seem to want their kids to be exposed to God kind of like they never were. And they want help in introducing their children to God in a meaningful way. Many times I have met people who have worshiped with us for the first time, and I say out on the sidewalk, "So nice to meet you. Thank you for coming to our assembly. How can we help you?" And often they will say, "Well, we're just kind of wondering what you have for kids. What have you got for teens? I have some teenagers. What are your children's programs here like?" Had a family walk in, worshiped with us one time, met me outside afterwards, and they said, this is the first thing they said to me, "We would like you to baptize our children." And I said, "Great, let's get together and talk about what the Bible says about that." So we did. We met. I showed them that baptism in the Bible is always for people who are believing in Jesus and repenting of the evil in their lives. It's always asked for by the person who's getting baptized. I told them, we don't baptize babies. We do parent dedications. And we had one coming up, and I invited them to come and see that. And they came, and they saw how involved our congregation is with the families who are dedicating themselves to raising their kids to know Jesus. And afterwards, I said, "So, what do you think?" They said, whoa, like, "We're going to have to rethink this. That's a serious commitment, what you're talking about." And I said, "Right, you wanted your children to be baptized, right?" And they said, "Well, yeah, but not that." And they went away for a long time. But that family came back later and they said, we weren't prepared for what you were asking, but for our kids, we will do whatever is good. And what we found over the years is that even though parents say that they're coming for their kids, and that this is the good part, the parents, while they're here, find themselves challenged by the gospel as well. They always say, "It's not for us. It's just for our kids. I'm just here for our kids." But it turns out to be for them too. Because the religion that they didn't know and rejected long ago is not what they find us doing here. In fact, one mom saw her son starting to hang out with kids from our youth group, and he was hanging out a lot with our youth group. More and more, her son would get up on Sunday mornings and come here voluntarily, which he never did on any other day of the week. Get up voluntarily? So one Sunday, she decided to sneak in behind him, and she sat in the back. She told us later that she decided that morning she was going to see for herself what kind of cult her son had got into. Later, not too long after that, her son was baptized into Christ. Later, not too long after that, her son baptized her into Christ. And that family still lives with Jesus for Jesus today. Our strategy as a church is to impact families around here by helping kids feel loved and valued, teaching them to find a meaningful connection with Jesus, and as that happens more and more, we'll have a chance to reach the parents too. We built this building in 1999, not as a worship center with beautiful windows and awesome acoustics. We built this building as a gymnasium with protective coverings on the windows and walls that cannot be broken. So far, so good. We built this building like a school with lots of classrooms, and lots of grass for kids to run around on outside. We built this building as a community rec center where kids could play and hang out and be friended and learn about Jesus. After Maggie's camp was here, one of their leaders said, you guys have the perfect building for loving and teaching and feeding 100 kids for a week. I said, and introducing them to Jesus, and he said, yes, you do. We've hosted a homeschooling group here for 2 years now, every Monday. Lots of families use our building every Monday, and they're teaching kids reading, writing, arithmetic, and a relationship with Jesus. And every week, as they inundate our building, as they walk in, they always say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is such a great space." They finished their school year last May. One teacher came back this week to start prepping for the new year, and she walked into the building, and she came into my office. She said, "It's such a great feeling to be back here." I said, "You don't like summer?" She said, "I love summer, but so much good happens in this building." Which is true. Which is why we spend time and energy on our Willowbrook Kids stuff. That matters. Classes each week. Events where families raising kids to know Jesus get together. Fall festivals with lots of candy. Easter egg hunts with lots of candy. Camp with lots of candy. We've got a bunch of parents and kids down at Mountain View this weekend. First chance weekend, I went down, I spoke on Friday night, the opening night of the weekend program. They asked me to come down and preach to the kids for about 15 minutes, they said. And I should realize that the audience includes K through fifth grade and their parents and their grandparents. I said, okay, what am I aiming at here? Am I like aiming at the kindergartners or the third graders or the fifth graders or the grandparents? They said, yes. 15 minutes that'll help all of them. We're doing the fruit of the Spirit this weekend. You get the first two, go. And some of you know that I'm kind of leery about preaching down there. Preaching at camp has left some scars on me in the past. Like after I preached a sermon once in the chapel building, a junior high girl walked out and she said, Mr. Walker, I just figured it out. Your sermons aren't really long. They just seem that way. Like the guy who listened to me preach one time and he said, your sermon tonight was like water to a drowning man. And at first I thought, no, that's not good. But they asked me to come preach, and I've been taught that if we live for Jesus, we should commit to produce and then produce. So I agreed, and I preached. And during the singing, the songs, they sang and danced a song that came straight from the Bible. It came from Galatians chapter 5. It was, but the fruit of the Spirit, I'm not going to do the dance part. I'm not going to sing. I'll just read it to you. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. They had a song that they sang about that. And to start off the sermon, I told them that if they would ask him to, Jesus would teach them how to do those nine things well. Nine things that Jesus will teach you how to do. And the first joke I used at the beginning didn't go so well. I said, so a friend of mine from Germany asked me if I know what number comes after eight. And when I said nine, he said, that's okay, John. I'll ask somebody else. Maybe they'll know. And everyone in the chapel building just kind of looked at me, like some of you are. So I decided I better skip my next joke, because that, if they didn't get that one. So I went on to my third joke. I said, do you hear about the teacher who asked her students, what's half of eight? And one student raised his hand. He said, up and down or across? And the teacher said, what? And the student said, well, half of eight up and down is three, but half of eight across is zero. So I told that joke and got about the same response. Well, no, there was a lot of whispering going on, but there was no laughter. So I just kept going. I said, how about this one? Why was six afraid of seven? And at that point, the room exploded, and all the kids raised their hands, and all of them stood up and said, ooh, 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 ooh. I said, what? They said, we know. One of them said, six was afraid of seven because seven, eight, nine. And then they all laughed when they tell the jokes. I went on to talk about how Jesus knows how to love people, and he'll teach us that. Jesus knows how to have joy in life no matter what, and he'll teach us how to do that. And the kids were mostly quiet, listening, I think, with some occasional moments of more whispering throughout the room. And I found out later that the whispering was mostly the parents trying to explain my jokes and my stories to the kids. At one point, I told a story about a boy who found a robin's egg on his way home from school, perfectly round, sky blue, beautiful robin's egg, and he wanted to show his family. He was so proud of what he found, but nobody was home when he got home, so he just left it on the kitchen table and said, I'll show them when they all get back. But later, his older brother walked in when nobody was around, saw the robin's egg on the table, thought it was a jawbreaker, popped it into his mouth, and bit down hard. And the mom of that family said she had two very unhappy boys in her home that night. And when I told that story, all the adults in the room did just what you did. And most of the kids just looked at me like nothing. But then one young man over here raised his hand. And as I make it a habit not to ever call on people during my sermons, I did not. He left his hand up for the rest of the sermon. I was very impressed with his perseverance. I never called on him. Afterwards, as soon as it was over, he came out of the chapel building, found me, and he said, I found a nest of robin's eggs once. And they were not perfectly round. They were oval. I said, wow. He said, that's all, and he walked away. But here was the best part, at least for me, and I didn't know this happened till later. They're all working on fruit of the Spirit this weekend. They're going to learn the 9 different things that God grows inside of us, what God gives us through his Spirit in us, what we can get better at. And my overall point of the sermon was, if you ask Jesus to, he will show you how to love people and be joyful. And I used examples from the Bible, and I used silly jokes, and I used mission trip stories to try to help the kids see that. And at one point in my sermon, I said, Jesus can teach you how to love if you'll ask him to, if you'll let him. Do you want him to? And I didn't know this, but a little boy in the back of the room raised his hand and said, yes, I do. They were so cute. They were tiny, but they were very cute. So young, so little, but they're already having opportunities to learn from Jesus at Mountain View. Senior week for high school students starts today, this afternoon. And I know it's good for kids to work summer jobs. I know that it's strategic for kids to play travel ball. I know family vacations matter. I know all that. But I also know that 1 week of being surrounded by trees and good food and uplifting music and godly adults who are paying attention to your kids can do them a lifetime of good. And kids who have never fit in can. And kids who have never even thought about Jesus will. And kids who have always been the most popular will find something even better. And kids who have always chosen the wrong friends will make better ones. And kids who are not good, when they are cleaned out and cleaned up and challenged for a week, come back good. One man a long time ago said, you can't really tell if a youth ministry is good or bad until 25 years after the youth ministry. And looking back at Mountain View Christian Camp 25 years ago, many of those kids who were just kids there are now living for Jesus in churches all over the world. And many of them are working with Christian camps in summers all over the world. And some of them have come back and are leading stuff at Mountain View. And back then, when I heard that first said that you can't judge a youth ministry until 25 years down the road, I used to think there would be nothing in the world more important to me as a father, and I mean nothing, than if 25 years from now, my kids were leading other kids to Jesus. And because of what my kids learned from this church, and because of friends that my kids made at Mountain View, my kids are doing that. What do you hope the kids you love are doing 25 years from now? And if they don't want to go? But that's true for school, and you make them go. But what if it costs money to send them? What if they lose money from not working this week? But you gladly spend $3,000 to help them have straight teeth. Are not straightened out lives more valuable than teeth? You say, John, but I think it's kind of too late. I fear I have missed the window of opportunity. But farmers, after a long drought, even if it rains a little, they say there's a chance. It may not rain much, but even a little can sometimes save a harvest. And if it's too late for your kids, it's too late. But if it's not too late, how can you not try? By the way, it's almost never too late. Jairus' daughter died before Jesus got to her, and he still made that all come out good in the end. If you can bring your child and Jesus together, it is not too late. So please, for the love of God and for the love of your kids, if you have a teenager in your life that you love, send them to camp this week. Because your kids rightly connected to Jesus, your family rightly connected to Jesus, that's what we're aiming at. Because in this part of the world, that's probably the best advertisement for the gospel there is. More than anything else, a family with kids who love God and they love each other and they love other people, a family like that shines like stars in a night sky. Which is why Willowbrook has always worked so hard to make our ministry to kids rock. Did you hear about the high school teacher who stopped class one day and she said, okay, now someone today has stolen my purse right off my desk. And it's got $100 in it. Now, I know you're basically all good kids, so I am willing to offer $10 to the person who turns it in, no questions asked. And it was quiet in the room for a moment, And then a voice from the back of the room said, I'll give you 20. I always thought, wouldn't it be cool if Willowbrook could offer people something better than anything else out there? Like, wouldn't it be cool if we could do miracles? Wouldn't it be cool if we could bring people back from the dead like Jesus did? Wouldn't that be great? What an impression that would make on people. But then one year, as camp ended, I realized we kind of do. We give kids back to their parents after camp with new life inside of them. Kids who have been written off. Parents who have said, or at least thought, that kid is dead to us. We send them home different, better, alive. They come home brand new. And in this way, the world sees how great Jesus really is. I thank you for living it. I thank you for investing in it. I thank you for making it possible. By the way, here's the end of the story. In Luke 8:49, it says, while he was still talking, while Jesus was still talking, someone from the leader's home came up to him and told him, your daughter died. No need now to bother the teacher. Most parents, if asked what they want for their kids today, would say, I just want them to be happy. Jairus would have answered, I just want her to be alive. Jesus overheard that and said, don't be upset. Just trust me and everything will be all right. Going into the house, Jesus would not let anyone enter with him except Peter, James, and John, and the child's parents. Everyone was crying and carrying on over her. Jesus said, don't cry. She didn't die. She's sleeping. They laughed at him. They knew she was dead. They knew. Those people knew where there's life, there's hope. But where there's death, there's no hope. But with Jesus, even where there's death, there's still hope. Verse 54, then Jesus, gripping her hand, called, my dear child, get up. She was up in an instant, up and breathing again. He told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were ecstatic, but Jesus warned them to keep quiet. Don't tell a soul what happened in this room. And the only thing that's different for us is when Jesus takes the hands of our children and brings them back from the dead to new life. The only thing different is he wants us to tell everybody. Everybody, because the secret's out. The kingdom's here. It's time to help people know what we know about him. The joke that I skipped when I preached at First Chance Camp on Friday night, the joke that I skipped went like this. Do you know what benign is? Benign? Benign is what you be after you be eight. Benign. Do you know what you be after you invite Jesus into your home? Yes, yes, you do know. You know that when Jesus is invited in, you be better. But not everybody knows that. And our church's goal is to change that a view at a time. Let's pray.